This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Julia Jacobs. It's time for Law and Behold. And today we are discussing a man facing a charge in the Selangor Sharia High Court for allegedly attempting to commit unnatural sexual intercourse. Now, he has been granted leave by the federal court to commence a constitutional challenge on a provision in the Selangor Sharia law for which he was charged under. So I know that's a lot to take in. So we're going to unpack what all of this means with Ki Hui Yi, who is a practicing lawyer at Kanasalingam & Co., and Michelle Yesudas, who is a senior legal advisor at the International Commission of Jurists in the Myanmar office. Welcome, both of you. How are you today?
Hello, I'm good. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Hi. Yeah, it's really great to be on this show with you. Thank you for having me as well.
Yes, lovely to have you both. So we are, of course, discussing this very interesting case that has come up. Okay, but before we start, I think it's very, very important that we state that this is not a challenge against Sharia law. Right? This is a constitutional challenge, right? But now going to the case, you know, let's start at the very beginning. Back in November 2018, 11 men were caught by Jais for attempting to have quote unquote unnatural sex. In this case, the men were allegedly having sex with other men in Bangi. And can you explain what they were charged under following their arrest?
So just to recap what Juliet said earlier, why we said this is not a challenge against Islamic law or Sharia law. It is in fact a challenge against the state power to make laws and also the parliament's power to make law. We will talk more on that later. So coming back to the facts of this case, back in November 2018, these 11 men were arrested by Jais and they were charged under Section 28 of the Sharia Criminal Offences Selangor Enactment 1995. So just allow me to read this section out for you. Mm-hmm. It says that any person who performs sexual intercourse against the order of nature with any man, woman or animal is guilty of an offence and shall be liable on conviction to a fine not exceeding 5,000 ringgit or to imprisonment for a term not exceeding 3 years or to whipping not exceeding 6 strokes or to any combination of the above punishments. So these men were charged under this section. And in the present case, the accused persons, in fact, actually five of them, pleaded guilty in the Sharia court and they were sentenced to jail time, fines and canings. And from what we gather from the news, they have appealed against these punishments, so to speak, and their appeal is still pending in the Sharia High Court. And what happened was that one of these 11 men, because the rest of them did not plead guilty, which means they claimed trial in the Sharia court, and one of these accused who did not plead guilty filed an application in the federal court to challenge the constitutionality of Section 28. And his trial in the Sharia court is now stayed pending the outcome of this constitutional challenge.
Okay. All right. So, you know, following their arrest, what exactly transpired after that?
So, like I said earlier, they were arrested in back in 2018. So only a year later, they were convicted. They were sent. They were sent to jail, as I understand from the news. And like I said earlier, they appeal against the five of them have appealed against these punishments. And as far as we know, at this stage, we don't know what's the outcome of the appeal in the Sharia High Court. And so, yeah, and of course, we have read online that some of these accused, when they were arrested, they were humiliated, they were asked to strip, to show their body in front of the enforcement officers and things like that. Although these are the facts not actually reported in the newspaper, but some of the NGOs have spoken on this issue. So maybe Michelle can give a broader picture on this.
Okay, sure. So you've painted a very important picture here, because I think a lot of the time when you have cases like this of people who were allegedly queer, arrested, detained, a lot of the time information is not enough. And also a lot of the time, because we've also seen in there's some very good news reports and also some activist-based news sources, such as maybe Queer Lapis, and there are other organizations as well putting up a lot of documentation on this. So documentation is very important. And so there have been information that some of them have had to go for religious counseling, like to say that they're insaf or taubat. And this is based on their imputed sexual orientation, gender identity or expression. And so even though this is very rarely said in the public space, like according to international law, when you make people bertaubat because of who they are or something that they can't change, it's actually considered torture or an inhumane treatment. So when you make people to feel that they are not human, or if you photograph them nude, or if you beat them during an arrest, these all are acts that could amount to torture. So that is just one element that I think a lot of the time, and this is all over the world, even in Myanmar, there are cases of law enforcement arresting people and catching people. And if there is any sort of act of violence, it's almost not documented. So you have these issues, but also I just wanted to emphasize the point that in this case, there were, if I'm not mistaken, 5 people who were actually already caned. And there's one thing that we need to know, that the caning of people, especially if you look at on the basis of imputed sexual orientation, gender identity and expression, is actually a clear violation of Malaysia's international obligations. Because a lot of people forget that Malaysia is actually a signatory to quite a few international human rights conventions, which include the one on women, CEDAW, people with disabilities, and the one on children. And when you sign on to these treaties, you have obligations and you have duties. And so amongst these duties is actually to prevent discrimination, to uphold equality, and also to protect privacy of people. And also, when you cane, it is also actually a violation. Malaysia has an obligation to also prevent, prohibit, and stop prosecuting all forms of torture, cruel and inhumane or degrading treatment. So I think like what also is often lost in the conversation is that government of Malaysia is actually one of the few countries in the world that still continue to have corporal punishment in the law, the caning. So the government of Malaysia should actually consider maybe reviewing and abolishing this practice, because it's been condemned worldwide, even by the UN Human Rights Council Special Rapporteur on Torture.
Okay, so maybe you can also help our listeners who might not know, you know, could you give us an overview of the dual legal system for Sharia law and federal law, you know, and that there, I think that there is in the penal code an offence for unnatural offences, and then there's also many provisions in the Sharia law about unnatural offences as well in each state. So, I mean, maybe you can help unpack what all of that means.
Okay, so in our federal constitution, Article 1211A actually provides that the High Court of Malaya and High Court of Sabah and Sarawak shall have no jurisdiction in the matters within the jurisdiction of Sharia court. So Sharia law governs personal law, for example, marriage, inheritance, and apostasy. In other words, Muslims in our country are subjected to what we call the normal law and also the Sharia law. And just before we go into, you know, the various provisions under the Sharia law and also the penal code, I think maybe Michelle can give a big picture about how does Sharia law actually works, because I know there have been debates about how Sharia law, although on paper we say it doesn't affect non-Muslims, but in reality, it does have some impact on non-Muslims in our country.
Okay, yeah. So I'm going to definitely have to agree with you on that. You see, like, we are lawyers, and I used to practice. And I think whenever lawyers do talk about the conversation on Sharia law, on jurisdiction, very much of the time the conversation is closed up, where people say that if you are not Muslim, you are not supposed to talk about these issues. But oftentimes, I think this is a flawed perception where, you know, when just because the law on paper is only applicable to people who are Muslim. But the reality is that people think that we live very separate lives. But I think it's an incorrect one. People don't live separate lives. We are connected to each other in so many ways. You have, you know, friends from different races and religion, friendships, family relationships. And so when you have Muslim and non-Muslim identities, it's actually very difficult sometimes to say that we are completely separate. Mm. So I always use an example of how it is important for everybody to actually know what's going on in the law, for everybody to be aware of how these laws are in practice, because it impacts everybody, regardless of your religious background or non-religious background. So like in 2012, an example I always use was actually an Indonesian Catholic woman in Penang. Her name was Halima. She was a spa worker and she was illiterate. So then she was charged in the Penang Sharia court for Kalwat, close proximity. And she was charged and she was dragged through court. And it actually took her 2 years to actually quash the charge under Section 27 of the Criminal Offences Penang Enactment. So it took her such a long time to actually administratively free herself just because of how the entire system of prosecution works. And so this is just one example, and this is a reported example. I'm sure there are many others that have fallen through the crack. Also, that's why I'm really glad that you're having this talk, because it's important to involve as many people as possible to be part of the conversation so that we can come up with better solutions for better lives, basically.
I think another example that I can give is how we see our family members, for example, like my brother or my sister, or even say my spouse converts to Islam. Mm-hmm. So it actually affects us to a certain extent, especially say when I marry a man, he's a non-Muslim, that's fine. Then, but I don't know, 10 years down the road, he decides to change his religion and he becomes a Muslim. Then you can see that sort of impact. It affects, although now the law says that if one partner converts, then the marriage immediately dissolves. But of course, you can see the long-term impact on, say, the children or distribution of assets and things like that. So these are just, I would say, day-to-day example that we actually see very often. It's just that if we read on papers, read on social media, but if it doesn't really happen to us, then we don't feel the impact, but it is actually happening.
Yeah, and I think that's a very important point to make. You know, everything is connected. It might one day affect you as well. I'm speaking today to Ki Hui Yi. She's a practicing lawyer at Kanasalingam & Co. and Michelle Yesudas, who is a senior legal advisor at the International Commission of Jurists in the Myanmar office. And we're discussing a landmark case. A constitutional challenge has been allowed over a Selangor state law. And we're going to discuss that a bit more after this quick break. You're listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. It is time for Law and Behold, our ongoing series aimed at improving constitutional literacy among Malaysians, done in collaboration with the Malaysian Bar and the University of Malaya's Faculty of Law. And joining me today are Michelle Yesudas, who is a senior legal advisor at the International Commission of Jurists, Myanmar office, and Ki Hui Yi, a practicing lawyer at Kanasalingam & Co. So we're discussing a landmark case. You know, a constitutional challenge has been allowed over a Selangor state law. So, in this current case, as we were discussing earlier, you know, one of the 11 men who was charged by the Sharia court has made a petition to the federal court. So what is he challenging in this petition exactly?
So the applicant, like I said earlier, he's challenging the validity of Section 28 of the Sharia enactment. Mm-hmm. And what he's on the ground that the state legislature is incompetent or has no legislative power over the offences of unnatural sex. So if we look at Article 74 of our federal constitution, this article actually, if I put it this way, it limits the legislative power of the federal legislature, our parliament, and the state legislature. So if we look further, in the ninth schedule is what we call the legislative list. We have a federal list which specifies the subject matters in which our parliament can pass the laws on. And we also have the state list governing the subject matters where the state legislature has the power to make laws on. And of course, we also have concurrent lists So this list has subject matters that have overlapping legislative power between the federal and state governments. So one simple example that we have seen recently is that, if you remember during the MCO, there was a debate about some of the states did not want to follow what the federal government has ordered or have said.
That's right.
So that's a debate for another day. But in that aspect, it was about public health. So interestingly, public health falls under the concurrent list. So basically, the federal and also the state governments, they have power to make laws on public health issues. So this is just one of the examples. And back to our case today, the applicant is challenging the state's power to pass the law, Section 28, which is about unnatural sex, whether the state actually has power to legislate on this criminal offence. The applicant's counsel argued that the creation of offences in relation to unnatural sex falls under item 4H of the federal list and not the state list.
Mm.
So item 4H says that federal legislature shall have the power to create offences in respect of any of the matters included in the federal list or dealt with by the federal law. So if we also look at item 1 of the state list, although it gives power to the state legislature to legislate on the, I'll just quote the provision, creation and punishment of offences by persons professing the religion of Islam against precepts of that religion. But there is a preclusion clause. It says, except in regard to the matters included in the federal list. So as I explained earlier, offences regarding unnatural sex is already dealt with by the federal law, specifically under the Penal Code. If we look at Section 377 all the way to Section 377E, it deals with sexual intercourse against the order of nature. So the applicant is saying that since unnatural sex has been dealt with by the Penal Code, the state has no power to legislate on this area, which is why he's saying Section 28 of the Sharia enactment is unconstitutional.
Okay, all right. And I understand that he has also filed two separate court challenges in the civil courts. What are these challenges, and you know, what is his aim in filing these two separate challenges?
So basically, the ultimate aim of these two challenges is to challenge the validity what we call the constitutionality of Section 28 of the Sharia enactment, which was used to charge him in the Sharia court. So one of these challenges is the one that we are talking about, the one that he had just gotten the leave from the federal court, is to challenge the constitutionality of this provision directly. So under the federal constitution, the federal court has the discretion, has the power to declare certain law unconstitutional on certain grounds. And the other challenge that he has filed is what we call the judicial review. In that challenge, he is also seeking to declare Section 28 unconstitutional, and he's also seeking further reliefs such as quashing the charge in the Sharia court, discontinuing the Sharia proceeding, etc. And as I understand it, for the judicial review, leave has been granted and it is now stayed pending the decision of this constitutional challenge in federal court.
Okay. And this is a pretty big thing, right? This constitutional challenge. But I mean, we'll get into that. What is the Sharia offence that's in question?
So as I said earlier, I've read out Section 28 of these Selangor Sharia criminal offences. So in short, it is the provision says that it is a crime to have sexual intercourse against the order of nature with any man, woman or animal. Any offenders can be punished by a fine up to 5,000 ringgit, a maximum 6 years of jail time, not more than 6 canings or any combination of the above punishments.
Okay. And I think it was quite interesting for some Malaysians who did not know that, do we have actually the right to challenge the constitutional validity of certain laws in Malaysia? I mean, could you elaborate on that? Can Malaysians then challenge any law at all?
So yes, there is a mechanism provided for us under Article 4.4 of the Federal Constitution. So under Article 4, you can challenge the laws made by Parliament or the state governments on the ground that either they did not have the power or was not under their scope to make such law. If either of these conditions apply, then it can be challenged in the federal court. However, you would need to apply for leave from the federal court before you can argue or you can ventilate your arguments fully. Mm-hmm. Also, Article 4.1, as most of us know, that federal constitution is the supreme law of the land. You know, we always hear Prof. Shad says on BFM, it's a law of the law of the land. So any law passed which is inconsistent with the federal constitution is actually void. So we can actually challenge the constitutionality of the laws passed by the parliament or the state legislature.
Mm-hmm. And Michelle, is there anything that you'd like to add to that?
Yes, for sure. So I'd like to first echo what we has been saying, that our country is it's a country where the constitution is supreme. And if our laws are in breach of the constitution, it should not be in effect. However, it is not uncommon for lawyers to actually file constitutional challenges. But I think a lot of the language also, whenever you speak to the public, like sometimes it's also not always talked about in this way, especially now recently because of the political events. But if we remember, during the Najib administration, especially in the year from 2013 to 2015, some of us might remember the over-enthusiastic use of the Sedition Act, 1948, where there was a steep incline in people being charged in court for a variety of reasons. You had people charged for criticizing the federal court decision in Anwar Ibrahim's criminal appeal. You had people who were charged for criticizing the election results, people who were saying certain things on Twitter. And so examples actually of constitutional challenges, actually there were so many, and I think many of us still remember these recent examples. You had when Zunar, the cartoonist, was charged for Sedition Act, and I think he had a whopping 9 charges piled on him. We also had Adam Adli, student activist, and also the late state assemblyman Mat Shuhami Shafi. So I think one good example of how constitutional challenges can actually be a very good way to raise awareness and also to have courts recognize how important it is to ensure that laws are constitutional is when they do this exercise of constitutional challenges. So Mat Shuhami filed an application in 2014 where he was seeking to declare Section 3 and Section 4 of the Sedition Act. I'll not go into it, but Section 3, it does not define the element that you required when you have seditious thoughts. You have seditious words. You don't need an intention. Like, doesn't say anything else. And Section 4 is, it defines what sedition actually means. And Section 3 and Section 4 are very, very widely and arbitrarily defined. And so almost anything can actually fall within Section 3 of the Sedition Act, if my memory serves me well. And so in what has happened is that in a landmark judgment, the Court of Appeal has actually ruled that Section 3 of the Sedition Act violated the Constitution, Article 10, which is the provision for freedom of expression in Malaysia. And so because this section was against Article 10, this section then became null and void. And so the main point of this challenge was actually that whenever you have a crime, usually and when you do criminal law, you should actually have like the mental condition, the mens rea, and so you should have an intention when you're committing a crime. But the Sedition Act was, you know, so special and so unique that it didn't even require intention. So then this was put to the court, and then the court realized that Section 3 that sets out this situation is against the Constitution. And so what happened was that the judge also highlighted some very salient points where, because of the wide and arbitrary nature of the Sedition Act, it would actually leave the door open to selective prosecution. However, the case was actually overturned in the federal court, but in that window, there were actually many opportunities for lawyers in other pending cases to mount this argument. There was also a moratorium placed on the Sedition Act after the Court of Appeal decision. And also it also highlights the importance to actually implement urgent law reforms, such as the review and the abolition of laws like the Sedition Act. So constitutional challenges are very, very key to having a working democracy, as well as for everybody to understand their constitutional rights. Because the Constitution is a living document. I think a lot of people just think that it's over and done with, it's in the books, you learn it in law school, but it's actually a living document. And the more we interact with it through court, through challenges, the more people are aware of their duties and their rights in society. Yeah.
And can litigation in court and these sorts of constitutional challenges, can they actually bring about some positive changes in the lives of people, of Malaysians?
Of course, the answer is yes. If we look at cases like Noor Fadilah case, the Bin Abdullah case, Indira Gandhi. So I'll just pick Noor Fadilah. Noor Fadilah is about the right to equality, gender equality. So in that case, the teacher was, she applied for a temporary teaching job with the government. And then when they found out that she was pregnant, they revoked their offer. So she filed a challenge in court. So these are the life examples that we see that it actually impacts people's life. Eventually, Noor Fadilah got damages because the government has breached her constitutional right. So, yeah, and if we look at cases like Indira Gandhi, it's about freedom of religion and things like that. So definitely constitutional challenges bring positive changes to all Malaysians.
I just wanted to take us to a bit more global as well, because I think that sometimes there might be some thoughts where if you were to challenge the law and if you were to talk about things like human rights or rights-based litigation, you might be seen as being non-Western or being liberal. But the truth is that actually a lot of very progressive jurisprudence has actually come from our neighbours, from other Asian countries, from people that are very close to us. So a very good recent example would be the India Supreme Court decision in 2018 September in the Navdeep Singh Johar case, where you had a combination of more than a decade of awareness, development of public interest litigation in India, and also activism from the grassroots. So it actually decided that the criminalization of consensual same-sex relationships under Section 377 of the Indian Penal Code violates the Indian constitutional provisions and also international provisions on equality, non-discrimination, and privacy. It also has done something quite landmark and groundbreaking, where it also looks at international instruments such as the Yogyakarta principles. And so as a result of this decision, it actually has ended the threat of many lives of people. But of course, when something goes to court, litigation is only the beginning. You also have many, many other parts of life that, you know, we have to look at, and it's a constant progress of how people work together, interact together to improve institutions and social systems, really.
Okay, and I mean, just going back to the case at hand, you know, I'm curious to know what the arguments that were put forth by the Selangor government's lawyer regarding this petition.
Okay, so at the leave stage, the lawyer actually raised a preliminary objection that the Selangor government has been wrongly named as a party in that suit, because he was arguing that the Selangor government actually has no power to execute the impune provision, which is Section 28 of the enactment. MAIS, Majlis Agama Islam Selangor, and also JAIS should be named as parties. But the court said that the state government ought to be named as a party because this is what is required by Article 4 of the Federal Constitution. And this is only leave stage. So for this kind of challenge, like I said earlier, you would need a leave, which is like a sort of a permission from the court to challenge what you want to challenge, which is the constitutionality of the provision of certain law. So the court says this is just, I'm just giving you the permission to put your argument before a panel. And if other parties, for example, MAIS or JAIS, they want to be part of this suit, they can just apply to intervene. And apart from that, they also argue that the application is frivolous, it doesn't have merits because Section 28 of the Selangor, the Sharia enactment, is not identical with Section 377A of the Penal Code. So basically, he was saying that it is fine. We have two separate provisions, one in the Sharia enactment, one in Penal Code, as long as the same individual is not prosecuted twice under these two different provisions. Mm-hmm. But this argument was rejected by the judge, and the court said that the question here is whether or not the state even has the power in the first place to legislate in this area, which is unnatural sex. And it's not about the implementation of these two provisions.
Okay, all right. So this challenge has been allowed. And would you like to give some of the reasons that were given by the federal court judge?
I'll just elaborate a bit more. The judge says that this case, they have a merit. The arguments that the applicant is putting forward has some merits. I will just give them the permission to ventilate their arguments before a panel of judges. So what he's saying is that it's not frivolous. You do have a case. You can argue about the constitutionality of Section 28. You are not wasting the court's time. You are not abusing the court process. So for now, I will just give you the permission. You have further arguments on the merits or whether Section 28 is constitutional. You just bring it up in the future hearing.
Okay. All right. And I guess what happens next, you know, I mean, it's a landmark case. I think everyone's going to be watching the outcome of this. But yeah, what is going to happen next?
So like I said earlier, leave has been granted. Now the parties will have to argue their case before a panel of judges in the federal court. And in this hearing, the panel will have to consider the merits of the arguments by the applicant and also the respondents to decide whether or not the Selangor State Legislature has the legislative power to enact Section 28. And as a result, whether or not Section 28 is constitutional. If Section 28 is declared as unconstitutional, it basically means that it will not have legal force anymore. The authorities cannot use this section to prosecute anyone.
Okay, that's quite major. Michelle, anything you'd like to add to that?
Sure. So, yeah, definitely, as Hui has said, this is, and you have said very rightly, this is something to watch, especially during the merits of the argument as to how the judge will, what arguments will be most compelling, what will be brought up before the court, and also the outcome of what happens to Section 28 and how people will react to this. Mm-hmm. But also, I think what's very important is that it's most important for the public to engage with this, because this is not merely for lawyers, but also understanding. I think not many people understand that we have a Selangor State Legislature, how it makes laws.
That's right.
So for me, every effort in drawing attention to how laws are made, how laws impact people, and how these laws can also be litigated on and challenged on, must always be encouraged and also promoted. And the people who are doing it should always also be taken care of and protected, because we can see some positive changes being made for people through litigation and spreading awareness. Because I think that's why this is such a great program to have. The more information you have about how the law works and how the court works and how legislative houses work, and then you can better engage with democratic processes and you can actually understand how day-to-day lives are actually more impacted by constitutional documents. So for me, it's actually all about raising awareness. It's just not for the lawyers.
All right. Thank you so much for joining me today. I've been speaking to Michelle Yesudas. She's a senior legal advisor at the International Commission of Jurists Myanmar Office, and Ki Hui Yi, a practicing lawyer at Ganesalingam & Co. And we were discussing a landmark case on the constitutional challenge allowed over a Selangor state law. And if you miss any part of this interview or any previous Law & Behold interviews, you can search for the podcast on our BFM app, available on Google Play, the App Store, and also on Spotify. This has been Live & Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.